Thank you for being here today. I'm impressed. Like, the room looks awesome for being in Hawaii. So I'm really excited that you guys are getting to come out and listen to what I've got to say. My name is Jessica Chitwood. I'm a PhD student starting my second year at the University of Florida. And today I want to tell you a little bit about some of the work we're doing towards breeding for resistance to fusarium wilt, race 3 in tomato. Okay, so I want to tell you like where the story starts and kind of how we got to where we are with the background in fusarium wilt and how the resistance that's currently available works. Then we'll tell you about where we are with the identified, the novel sources for resistance, and then the mapping populations, and then where do we go from here with the future work that'll go on from now. Okay, so fusarium wilt is caused by the soil-borne fungal pathogen Fusarium oxysporum. It's a form of Specialis lycopersici, so it's a sect within that species that only attacks tomato. It's a long-lived. Once it's in a field, it's a chlamydospore-forming pathogen, and so those chlamydospores can last 10 to 20 years. So basically, once it's in a field, the field has it forever. Current management was with fumigation practices, but with the phase out of methylbromide, I mean, even with methylbromide, fumigation wasn't 100% effective, and now that we've lost methylbromide in any kind of fumigation practice, we really don't have a good control besides genetic resistance. It causes chlorosis in the lower leaves, and it moves up the plant, and then wilt, which you can see in that picture there. That's a completely wilted plant, and so that will cause premature fruit ripening and then eventual plant death. So it's a real problem, and once it gets infected, it's the plant's going to die. There are three races of fusarium wilt, and I'm working with race 3 primarily. It's a growing threat. We've had it in Florida for quite a while, I think since like the 70s. It's a growing threat around the country. California is starting to experience more incidents, and around the world as well. So genetic resistance has been introgressed from wild species. Race 1, the I gene here, was introgressed from Pimpinella folium, and then race 2 is also introgressed from Pimpinella folium that confers resistance to race 2. You can see this is an example of wild species here. Race 3 actually has two resistance genes associated with it, the I3 gene and the I7 gene, both of which were introgressed from Solanum pinellii. All of these genes have now been cloned. We know that these two are located on chromosome 11. Mine's located on chromosome 7. I7, I think, is chromosome 8. But all of these have been cloned. There's lots of information about them, except for I7, it's not been used, really. There's almost every cultivar, I mean, I think, well, I don't know every, but there's a lot of cultivars out there that have I and I2. There have been commercially available I3 cultivars since the 90s, but nobody really has used I7. So the level of resistance it confers is a little bit in question, and how it would perform under field is in question, so it hasn't really been characterized yet. And then I3 cultivars, there's been some reluctance to take them up because, well, you saw that picture before with what a wild tomato species looks like. I3 has been associated with some negative traits horticulturally, like average fruit size. So you can see in this graph here, these two lines, the light blue bars here, represent a cultivar that does not have either copy of a functioning I3, so it's a homozygous for the recessive. And it has a lot, this is fruit size on this side, and you can tell it has the largest fruit size of all. And then you get to the heterozygous, and it's a step down for both. And these are two, one of our elite breeding lines, Florida 7907B and 8814. And then C, this dark blue, represents a homozygous for having the I3 gene. So you can see that I3 clearly has an effect on fruit size and reducing fruit size. It's also associated with bacterial spot sensitivity. So that is this right here. This is 7946. That's a I3 cultivar. And I3, the gene has been associated with bacterial spot sensitivity, which is a big enough problem on its own. We don't really want to increase sensitivity to that. And so it's caused growers reluctance to utilize these cultivars. So the question then is it because it was introduced from a wild species, do we have linkage drag going on, or is this pleiotropy? We're going to cross our fingers and hope it's not pleiotropy, but we're going to figure that out also. The ultimate goal for me is to create durable resistance to race 3. And for it to be a successful durable resistance, It needs to be long-lasting. I would prefer to have like multiple genes that we could stack into germplasm that were not associated with negative traits. If these genes are associated with small fruit size and increased bacterial spot sensitivity, growers are not going to want to use them. So they have to be standardized. You know, they have to be able to meet industry standards. So we can try to get rid of linkage drag if that is the problem by reducing the I3 introgression. We can characterize I7 so that we can begin utilizing it if it's going to be beneficial. But we should also identify and utilize novel sources of race 3 resistance. Solanum pinellii has been found to be very highly resistant to all races of Fusarium wilt. And so the resistance is out there. It could potentially be a different, what we're hoping is a different source than I3 or I7. And so it just needs to be identified. Okay, so this graduate student before me, Jen, he actually presented some of this data a few years ago at ASHS. He went through a lot of pinellii accessions and identified 42 from the Tomato Genetic Resource Center that had resistance to race 3, and he created an interspecific cross, the F1, and then backcrossed it again to cultivate a tomato and used the BC1 F1 population to check for whether it had I3, and if it had I3, he used molecular markers to select away from the locus. Let me show this graph. Okay, so he went to and looked at ratios and showed whether or not, if it had the I3 locus, did it have an effect or not. And so he went through and selected these here, where it says no, that it's either present or having an effect. And he went and selected away from the I3 locus, and then he was able to determine, based on the ratios, whether it was one locus, an I3 alternative, meaning it this was not I3, or two loci present, based on the ratios. So that's where I picked it up. We continued back crossing into cultivated tomato. I am now at the BC4 population, BC4 generation. I think we're going to continue to make some additional back crossing. Each time we make back crosses, we use disease screens to advance the resistance. So sow it in coal, in which you can see here. So sow these lines in coal and then inoculate them about 10 days after sowing. I use a root dip inoculation method with a concentration of about 10 to the 7th spores per mil. And then we transplant into trays here and let them grow for 4 to 5 weeks, about a month or so. And then I start checking I score them and whether or not they were resistant or susceptible. And then resistant plants can go to the field, and they can either be used to advance degeneration, or they can be used to collect pollen, and we can make back crosses in the greenhouse using those plants. So here's a great, I think it's going to show up. Oh, yeah. That nice brown streak, that right there is clear susceptibility to Fusarium. You can also see it in the tray from the top side. These plants will look, they'll start having chlorosis, they'll start being kind of wilty, or they'll just be dead, and that's great too. That means I don't have to slice them. Healthy plants have no vascular browning, and they're pretty easy to select. They look completely clean. Okay, so like I said, we had the BC4 F1 population. Over these back crosses, we hadn't been selecting for horticultural traits, so things like fruit size, fruit quality, that kind of thing, plant architecture. So in the BC4 F1, I began making those selections. We used markers to select away from the I7 locus. So we're pretty sure we don't have that now. That's awesome. I took single plant selections from the BC4 F1, and that would be the BC4 F2 seed. And I used those plants to analyze segregation ratios. So we inoculated those, and in the F2, if you see a single dominant gene, you're looking for like a 3-to-1, right? So here are some of my ratios. These are some that I found that were pretty likely to be just a single dominant gene, that the ratios looked pretty good. And so then when you think about if you're going to select populations for mapping, you want a few, but you can use phylogenetic information to select populations that might have different kinds of resistance. Because, again, you know, we're trying to create durable resistance. So it would be great if I could find more than one resistance gene. So I used phylogenetic relationships. The circles here, there's circles, there's a triangle there, and X's. Those represent three different phylogenetic groups. And you can see they're kind of aligned along this coast. So it kind of has to do with where they are from, where these species originated. The X group is mainly down here. The triangle group is in the middle, and the circle group is up top. So I used this information to go and look back at my ratios to pick out these four. So we decided that these four would be really great for mapping. So now what we're looking for I've inoculated, we inoculated in the spring as well, but I inoculated about 320 plants of each of the four populations. I'm looking for we're going to collect tissue and we're going to select healthy plants and susceptible plants, and I can use markers from the sole cap SNP chip to see, I'm going to use that data to see if we can map where the resistance is going to come from. Then we can, from that point, we'll be able to fine map these alleles and with the goal of adding to the resistance repertoire. It'll be great. So I'm finishing a little early, but that's okay with me. I just want to thank my lab. My lab is the best. I'm a student, I'm at University of Florida. We have research centers all over the place. And I am actually based in the one in Tampa, but I take classes in Gainesville. My lab has been crucial for me to keep my project going, and I just want to thank them for all of that. They're able to take care of some of the stuff when I can't be in the lab, and they're just fantastic. And then Dr. Gary Vallad's lab, they're the plant pathologists that we work with. They supply all of our fusarium and cultures and inoculum, and they're really great. And with that, I'll take questions. Okay, the question was, how do we differentiate the different races of fusarium wilt? One of the easiest ways is to use resistant cultivars. At least that's one of the ways that we can check it. So I know that, for example, Manipal has the I gene, Horizon has I2, and then a line that I could have that have I3, and so we can tell based on that what race we're working with as to what which of those controls dies, because we've had that problem actually where we thought we had one race, it was just a mix-up, and we thought we had inoculated with race 2 and we inoculated with race 3 or something. So now we always use those controls for that reason. But races are also they're morphologically a little bit different. So the race 1 tends to be a little bit more pink. Race 2 is kind of like a dull, like a light purple color, and then race 3 is a really dark purple, just in culture. That's not always the case, but you can tell morphologically some of the different variations, and then the Vallad lab can use PCR, I believe, to identify between races. Yes? I can. So what Dr. Lee found, he was looking for essentially three different phylogenetic groups. So we see circles up here, triangles and X's, and Jen had done this study as well and found that phylogenetic information was correlated to location of where the accession was collected, and so he analyzed both of those, and so what he found was that things that were collected in this region were a lot different, or not a lot different, but they were further apart in family relations. So if you collect something from up here, it's further related to something down here. We were just trying to be as separate as possible and still stick with the ratios, because, we are working with something that's introgressed from wild species, so we don't always see the beautiful, 3-to-1. There's lots of, 43-to-7 and, lots of things. And there's a lot of reasons that could be happening that we're not seeing ratios we would expect. Besides multiple genes, it could be a lot of things. So using this, we just tried to select things that were more likely than not to be different. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. No, it doesn't. It doesn't insure it. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I still have about 30 other accessions represented. From that initial population of 42, I still have about 30 of those that we're continuing advancing resistance in. We're just not using them as our mapping populations yet. Oh, okay, I'm done. Thank you.